Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, May 18th, 2025. This program was previously broadcast on February 9th, 2025. From Mind Matters in the December 2024 issue of Scientific American, reconnecting with old friends. People may be reluctant to reach out, but both sides are gratified when they reconnect, by Laura B. Acknon and Jillian M. Sandstrom. Take a look at the contact list on your phone. Chances are that you have dozens of names and numbers, but you're in touch with only a small subset of those people on a regular basis. Sure, some dormant entries may be functional, such as those for veterinarians or car repair shops. But some contacts are probably friends who have faded from your life for no particular reason. Whether it be the childhood friend who had a baby, the colleague who transferred to a new department, or the thoughtful neighbor who moved away, many of us can think of someone we care about, but with whom we have lost touch. Research from across the social sciences has consistently shown for decades that social relationships are critical for our mental and physical health. Indeed, having at least one person to count on in times of need is one of the top predictors of life satisfaction around the globe. As a result, we may expect people to go to great lengths to maintain their social connections, yet some inevitably wane, transforming active friendships into dormant contact list entries. In a paper published in the journal Nature Communications Psychology, we examined how many people have an old friend whom they care about but have lost touch with, and how willing they are to reach out to this person. In a series of seven studies conducted with more than 2,400 participants, we discovered that people are surprisingly reluctant to reconnect, although there are strategies for overcoming that feeling. We began by asking 441 university students in Canada whether they had someone with whom they had lost touch, and if so, how willing they were to call, text, or email this person now and in the future. An overwhelming majority, 91%, identified such a connection. People were neutral about the idea of contacting this person in the future, however, and even less willing to do so at the time. To explore this hesitation, we asked the same people about various barriers to reaching out. These participants had many concerns, but they worried most that their old friend might not be interested in hearing from them, and that it would be awkward to speak after so much time had passed. In other words, people seemed to worry about being an imposition in their friend's life. This worry is most likely unfounded. Research shows that friends we've lost touch with appreciate hearing from us more than we think. In fact, we discovered that if people could get past their worries, they were indeed interested in reconnecting. When we asked 199 young adults to think about either getting in touch with an old friend or hearing from one, they preferred the latter. It's not that people are uninterested, but rather that they are reluctant to initiate these interactions. So we conducted two experiments with more than 1,000 people to see whether we could encourage them to call or write to an old friend. This proved surprisingly tricky, even though we tried to make it as easy as possible. We recruited only people who were able to think of an old friend whom they wanted to reconnect with and who they thought would be happy to hear from them. Moreover, we made sure that participants had their friends' contact information, and we gave them a few minutes to draft a message. Despite these favorable conditions, fewer than a third of people sent the message. Yet people who did reported greater feelings of happiness immediately afterward than those who didn't. In addition to providing a supportive context, we tried to make the task even easier for people in several different ways. We told some of our participants not to overanalyze the situation and just press send. We encouraged others to take their friend's perspective and think about how much they would appreciate receiving a note from an old friend. We tried to downplay the fear of rejection by suggesting that participants should not expect to receive a response and instead should feel good about having performed an act of kindness by sending a message. None of these interventions were successful. Nothing we tried seemed to move the needle on the number of people who would reach out to an old friend. We were stumped until we realized that many obstacles participants identified when thinking about the task were similar to the ones that prevent people from talking to strangers. This similarity made us wonder whether the passage of time makes old friends feel like strangers. So we tested this idea. In one study, we asked 288 people how willing they were to engage in various everyday actions, such as picking up garbage, booking a dentist, an appointment, listening to a favorite song from childhood, and, critically, talking to a stranger. Sure enough, people were no more willing to reach out to an old friend than they were to pick up garbage or talk to a stranger. But here is the good news. One of us who authored this article, Jillian Sandstrom, has worked on an intervention shown to ease anxieties about conversing with strangers. We decided to adapt that approach, which entails practicing specific social interactions, to the case of reconnecting with old friends. We asked some of our study participants to complete a 3-minute warm-up exercise in which they sent messages to current friends and acquaintances. Meanwhile, others, our control group, simply scrolled through social media. Afterward, we encouraged everyone to contact an old friend. Only about a third of people in the control group sent a message, consistent with our previous experiments, but about half the people in the warm-up group did so. We think that practicing the behavior involved in reaching out to others reminded people of how simple it is to send a message and how enjoyable it can be to connect. Social relationships are a key source of happiness, but they fade for any number of reasons. That said, reaching out may lead to greater happiness and may be easier after warming up. So go through the contact list on your phone and message a few folks you talk to often, and then find someone you haven't spoken to in a while and have been missing, and try to get hold of them too. The authors of this article, Reconnecting with Old Friends, are Laura B. Acknon and Jillian M. Sandstrom. Laura Acknon is a professor of social psychology and director of the Helping and Happiness Lab at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia. Jillian Sandstrom is a senior lecturer in the psychology of kindness at the University of Sussex in England and director of the Sussex Center for Research on Kindness. This article appears in the department Mind Matters in the December 2024 issue of Scientific American. Some of our closest friends may be our pets. In the Science News issue, November 16, 2024, The Science Life reports on cats. One scientist put cats' liquid nature to the test. Because cats' ability to pour themselves into containers and flow through that tight space is well documented. Cats may seem solid, but they're actually somewhat liquid, at least according to one 2017 theoretical physics paper inspired by photos of cats pouring themselves into vases and fitting into tight crevices. Now, one researcher has taken this idea a step further, testing dozens of cats to see when they act more like liquids or solids. Cats fluidly move through tall and narrow nooks, but hesitate when they approach uncomfortably short holes. Biologist Peter Poingres of Eötvös Loránd University in Budapest reported in the October 18th issue of Science. The findings suggest that cats are aware of their own body size and may form mental images of themselves. Because cats tend to be reclusive, they are difficult to test in the lab. So the biologist brought the lab to the cats. With help from colleagues, he built a portable lab that they set up in 29 homes. In each home, the team attached two cardboard panels to a door frame, one with five rectangular holes of the same height, but decreasing width, and another with five holes of the same width, but decreasing height. An owner stood on one side of the panel, while the cat and the experimenter stood on the other side. For each trial, the cat had to squeeze from the experimenter's side to the owner's side, through the holes, while being filmed. Once a cat oozed through the hole, the owner had to catch their pet and hand them over to the panel to a researcher to start a new trial. But some cats hated being handled and evaded their owners. 30 out of 38 cats finished the experiment. When faced with holes of varying height, 22 cats hesitated to crawl through the shortest. When the holes varied in width, only 8 cats paused before approaching the narrowest cranny. Most cats squeezed through slim openings without hesitating. Hesitation may be a self-preservation tactic, the biologist says. If a cat squeezes through a hole without being able to see what's on the other side, the cat may be vulnerable to potential threats. That some cats paused in the safety of their homes suggests that they also rely on their body size representation, or how they imagine their body size, to plan their approach. The scientist had a lot of fun with the cats, but the funniest things are how the people behave, he says. Some owners thought their cats were geniuses, only for those cats to struggle with the test. Other owners thought their felines lacked intelligence and were shocked when the cats easily completed the test. And this report on one scientist who put cats' liquid nature to the test was written by Andrea Tamayo and appeared in the November 16, 2024 issue of Science News. The recent fires in Los Angeles have been a travesty, but so has the aftermath, the flooding that resulted from much-needed rain. In the November 16, 2024 issue of Science News, in the Department of Earth, why rivers abruptly change course. The answer could help communities prepare for potential floods. By Nick Ogasa. Shifting is in a river's nature, but when a river breaks free of its channel and carves a new path across the landscape, devastating floods may descend upon communities with little to no warning. For decades, researchers have struggled to explain exactly how river channels become primed for such sudden diversions or avulsions. A study that was published in the October 3rd issue of Nature may have finally quelled the debate, showing how two factors work together to stage the rerouting of a river. The researchers, building on their findings, also developed an algorithm that can predict the new path of an avulsed river. In some cases, these are monumental floods, civilization-changing floods, says sedimentologist Douglas Edmonds of Indiana University in Bloomington. In 2010, avulsions on the Indus River in Pakistan contributed to flooding that forced roughly 20 million people from their homes. Nonetheless, flood hazard models remain unable to predict where rivers will reroute, Edmonds says. It's really an invisible flood hazard. Avulsions require a setup and a trigger, an overburdened camel's back, and a final straw. The trigger could be a flood, an earthquake. It could be a logjam in a river, Edmonds says. The setup refers to how the deposition of sediment has primed a river for diverting, and it's the fundamental cause of avulsion, Edmonds says. Rivers experience floods all the time, but they don't avulse all the time. Edmonds and colleagues focused on defining the setup, for which there had been two competing hypotheses. One held that avulsions happen when a river becomes super elevated, or the deposition of sediment raises a river's banks and water level above the surrounding land. The other contended that avulsions occur when there is a slope advantage, that is, once the slope of a new potential path becomes steeper than that of the river's current path. Using satellite data to investigate roughly 170 avulsions, the team noted how far downstream rivers tended to divert and found that avulsions are about three times as common near river mouths and mountain fronts as in between. Focusing on 58 river channels for which high-resolution topographical data were available, the researchers measured the superelevation and slope advantage before avulsions. They found that superelevation best explained avulsions near the mountains, while slope advantage best explained those near river mouths and deltas. There's so much sediment flowing out of the mountains that the rivers just pile it up until they're super elevated and spill over, Edmonds says. Meanwhile, in deltas, there's a lot of cohesive mud that forms very steep natural levees around deep channels, and avulsions need a steep slope advantage to start cutting through the levee, he adds. These two factors, slope advantage and superelevation, work together in an inverse fashion, the researchers found. The more superelevated a river becomes, the less of a slope advantage it needs to avulse, and vice versa. It is the first time that anyone's been able to show that with data, says geologist Elizabeth Hajek of Penn State. Avulsions occurred when the mathematical product of the two factors surpassed a threshold value, the scientists found. So long as precise topographical measurements of a river's channel are available, which is more likely for larger rivers and in places with clear skies, you could probably use that threshold metric to identify where avulsions are likely to occur, says geomorphologist Vamsi Ganti of the University of California, Santa Barbara. The researchers developed a computer algorithm that highlighted where on a map an avulsed river might go, factoring in the steepness of the terrain and momentum of the river. When tasked with predicting the pathways of 10 past avulsions, the algorithm correctly captured the path of each one. It's a really nice tool, Hajek says. It could be really, really helpful for identifying areas of concern. The plan is to develop avulsion hazard maps for vulnerable regions or even globally, Edmonds says. Now that we have this metric, we can go measure it on rivers all over the world. This article, Why Rivers Abruptly Change Course, appears in the November 16, 2024 issue of Science News. Other research in this same issue of Science News shows how water and dirt can work together to support marine microbes. From the Department of Oceans, Saharan dust helps sustain ocean life. Atmospheric transport makes a key nutrient water-soluble. By Douglas Fox. As dust from the Sahara blows thousands of kilometers across the Atlantic Ocean, it becomes progressively more nutritious for marine microbes. Chemical reactions in the atmosphere chew on iron minerals in the dust, making them more water-soluble and creating a crucial nutrient source for the iron-starved seas, scientists reported in the September 19th issue of Frontiers in Marine Science in 2024. Dust clouds settling on the Atlantic can spawn phytoplankton blooms that support marine ecosystems, says Timothy Lyons, a biogeochemist at the University of California, Riverside. Iron is incredibly important for life, he says. Phytoplankton require it to convert carbon dioxide into sugars during photosynthesis. By studying dust transport and chemical reactions in the atmosphere, scientists could better understand why parts of the oceans are biological hotspots for phytoplankton and fish. Over 240 million metric tons of Saharan dust blow over the Atlantic Ocean each year. On Bermuda, the Bahamas, and other islands, it turns soils red, but much of it settles on the ocean, providing a major source of iron to areas that are too far from land to receive it from rivers. Lyons and marine geologist Jeremy Owens, then at UC Riverside, set out to answer a different dust question. Had the types of dust settling on the Atlantic changed over the last 120,000 years? The pair analyzed dust-derived minerals in four cores plucked from the seafloor in the eastern Atlantic near Africa and from farther west near North America. What they found prompted a different line of inquiry. In dust and soils around the world, roughly 40% of iron is ordinarily present within reactive minerals, such as pyrite or carbonates. This kind of iron can be decomposed by weak acids and potentially used by life. In the core samples from the bottom of the Atlantic, only about 9% of iron in the dust minerals sampled from near North America was made up of reactive iron minerals, compared with about 18% in dust minerals taken from closer to Africa. That, Lyons says, was the big surprise. During dust's several-day transatlantic flight, more and more of its reactive iron is altered, attacked by acids and ultraviolet radiation, which pries apart the minerals. Lyons and Owens, now at Florida State University in Tallahassee, concluded, "There are photochemical transformations that tend to make the iron more soluble in water," Lyons says. "As that modified iron settles into the ocean, it dissolves and gets devoured by phytoplankton. The only reactive iron that makes it to the seafloor is the stuff that isn't altered during air transport and later gobbled up." The researchers' results suggest that the farther the desert dust flies, the less of that iron is left. By spawning phytoplankton blooms, dust-derived iron may also nourish small fish and other animals that graze on plankton, as well as the predators that eat the grazers. A recent study suggests that Atlantic skipjack tuna, an important commercial fish, are attracted to areas where Saharan dust has settled. The new results are plausible because previous studies have shown that iron minerals react in the atmosphere, says atmospheric scientist Natalie Mohovald of Cornell University. "The new conclusion goes along with what I thought was happening," she says. But she also points out that Saharan dust isn't the only possible source of that iron. The samples came from far enough north in the Atlantic that some of the iron could have come from smoke, from wildfires in North America over the last 120,000 years, she says. To assess the dust's origin, Owens, Lyons, and colleagues measured the ratio of iron to aluminum and the ratio of light iron atoms to heavy iron atoms in the samples. Both measurements were consistent with the kind of dust that comes from the Sahara, they found. Analyzing sediment from more sites in the Atlantic could provide a clearer picture of how dust has blown across the ocean and changed chemically. And this article in the Oceans Department of the November 16, 2024 issue of Science News. The feature article from this issue of Science News is a love story. A love story between scientists and the evolutionary icon that they discovered, the Lucy skeleton. Fossil superstar. Discovered 50 years ago, Lucy remains an evolutionary icon, by Bruce Bauer. Inside a specially constructed safe at the National Museum of Ethiopia in Addis Ababa, sit the fragile remains of the world's most celebrated human ancestor. She was once a hardy survivor in an unforgiving environment, but now her partial skeleton receives round-the-clock protection in a temperature-controlled setting. In her prime, nearly 3.2 million years ago, this ancient female roamed East Africa's landscape. Standing a bit over 1 meter tall and weighing no more than about 30 kilograms, slightly taller and lighter than an average adult female bonobo chimp. She was not physically imposing, but her evolutionary stature and cross-cultural appeal are huge. Today, half a century after the discovery of her partial skeleton, people everywhere know Lucy. Discovering Lucy ushered in a new way of thinking about human evolution among late 20th century paleoanthropologists. At that time, many viewed human evolution as having proceeded along a straight line, with one ancient Homo sapien species leading directly to the next, until the emergence of present-day people. But Lucy's blend of human-like features, such as a curved spine, with ape-like traits, including a brain no larger than a chimp's and long arms, pointed to a more tree-like picture of human evolution. In that scheme, myriad species branched off in different directions, some dying out, and others leading to the Homo genus and eventually to us. Lucy's anatomical potpourri also sparked new questions about how two-legged walking evolved and the origin of humans' large brains. Perhaps most importantly, Lucy's discovery foreshadowed a series of fossil finds that filled in the scientific picture of her species. By 1978, enough evidence had accumulated to establish Lucy as the founding member of a previously unrecognized species, Australopithecus afarensis. On the 50th anniversary of her partial skeleton's discovery, Lucy commands much more name recognition than other fossils from humankind's evolutionary family, known as hominids, or increasingly, hominins. A look back at Lucy's story reveals how she has remained atop the hominid A list. In this case, geologic good fortune, skilled scientific scrutiny, and an inspired musical reference helped to turn an ancient relative into a household name. Get buried, but not too deep. Paleoanthropologist Donald Johansson and graduate student Tom Gray spent the morning of November 24, 1974, mapping and surveying possible fossil-bearing spots in a desolate region of Ethiopia. Walking back to their Land Rover through a gully at a site known as Hadar, Johansson noticed a forearm bone sticking out of the ground. A closer look confirmed that the bone came from a hominid. Johansson and Gray gingerly removed several more skeletal pieces from loose soil nearby. After two more weeks, the researchers and their colleagues had uncovered several hundred bone fragments, a big haul considering finding one ancient hominid skullcap or partial jaw can require weeks or months of careful excavation. From those finds, the team pieced together 47 fossil bones to form a small fossil skeleton, about 40% complete. It was the most complete early hominid skeleton at that time, by a lot. Geology had worked in Johansson and Gray's favor. Lucy's remains were not found where she died. Flooding had carried her body, probably shortly after death, into a sandy channel where a lake quickly formed. The burial under moist lake sediment kept her fossilized bones in relatively good shape, and the fossils were near enough to the surface that much later, after the lake had dried up, they began to emerge from eroding sandy sediment. Scientists continue to debate how Lucy died and whether scavenging by hyenas and other animals, trampling, or other factors explain her skeleton's missing pieces. But what remained popped out just enough from Hadar's surface to get the fossil party started. Stay close to fossil comrades. Part one of the geologic good fortune involved Lucy's skeleton. Part two ushered her species mates into view. Lucy was found on land that, although not evident at first, preserved bones of many of her contemporaries. Fossils unearthed from 1973 to 1977, including a knee joint that predated Lucy's discovery, but was only later recognized as part of her species, cemented Lucy's membership in a larger A. afarensis population. Those finds enabled scientists to distinguish between Lucy's East African species and a previously identified species of South African hominid in the same genus, Australopithecus africanus. Other generally accepted hominid species known at the time mostly belonged to the Homo genus, including Homo habilis, Homo erectus, and Homo neanderthalensis. As evidence for A. afarensis grew, Lucy came to symbolize the entire species. Fossils from several East African sites, some excavated as early as the 1930s, have since been incorporated into A. afarensis. Hadar has yielded about 90% of the nearby 600 fossils so far attributed to the species. Hadar's geology also gave Lucy a big advantage in the ancient dating game. The three Hadar sediment formations with A. afarensis remains each contain layers of volcanic matter and ash. Measures of the decay of radioactive argon into related forms in that volcanic material provided age estimates for the fossils. The ability to narrow down Lucy's evolutionary age in this way, shortly after her discovery, reinforced her status as an especially early hominid, the oldest known at that time, with an exceptionally preserved skeleton. While Lucy lived an estimated 3.2 million years ago, her species at Hadar and elsewhere existed from about 3.9 million to 3 million years ago, making her a flag bearer for a hominid species that had a 900,000-year run. To paraphrase an old Beatles song, Lucy topped the hominid hit parade with a little help from her friends. Names matter. Another Beatles song advanced Lucy's worldwide fame by providing a catchy, memorable phrase and a name. After the initial Hadar discovery, when Johansson and Gray returned to camp for the night with what looked like pieces of a hominid skeleton, they joined the rest of the team in a celebration. A tape recorder played the song, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, over and over during the festivities. The tune's psychedelic lyrics echoed the surreal events of that day. Joyous partiers started calling the newfound fossil Lucy. With that thoroughly modern moniker, familiar to people around the world, Lucy from the Gully in Hadar received a big boost toward fossil stardom. The origin of Lucy's nickname was far more raucous and spontaneous than is typical for fossil hominid specimens, which often get named for the place where they were found. Consider the Tongue Child, a three-year-old's fossil skull uncovered by miners at South Africa's quarry in 1924. Researchers generally agree that the discovery of this fossil, which may have lived anywhere from around 3.7 million to 2 million years ago, depending on age estimation methods, launched the modern era of fossil hominid studies. The skull turned researchers' attention away from Asia and toward Africa as the birthplace of hominids. In 1925, anatomist and anthropologist Raymond Dart assigned the find to Australopithecus africanus, a new species that he considered a direct ancestor of the Homo line. The position of the ancient child's skull opening for the spinal cord showed that the head rested directly above the spine, a hallmark of the ability to walk upright. Though the South African skull hinted that early hominids had adopted a two-legged gait before big brains, some researchers suspected that this species would have developed into a chimp-like, knuckle-walking adult. Tongue Child certainly deserves recognition in this centennial year of its discovery, but the fossilized Hadar female named for a trippy rock song has gained far more public acclaim than the ancient kid named after a quarry. Lucy goes by other names. Her formal designation, rarely used outside academic journals and scientific meetings, is AL-288-1, and Ethiopians today refer to the remains as Dinknesh, a word that in a regional language means, you are marvelous. On the world stage, though, the Hadar female answers only to Lucy. Inspire big evolutionary debates. Lucy would have appreciated the lyrics of another Beatles song that opens with, "I'm looking through you, where did you go? I thought I knew you, what did I know?" Her partial skeleton revealed enough anatomy to reshape debates about hominid evolution without supplying easy answers. 5 decades later, those disputes continue. At the time of the Hadar find, the fossil discoveries and evolutionary ideas of Lewis and Mary Leakey and their son Richard dominated anthropology. Lewis Leakey regarded human evolution as having occurred solely within the Homo genus. Probably starting with H. habilis, he argued, one Homo species led to the next without any branching into dead-end lines. South African Australopithecus, such as the Taung child, represented extinct ape species from his perspective. Big brains powered the rise of the Homo genus, and eventually people today, starting in Africa perhaps 3 million years ago, the Leakeys argued. Lucy, with a body built for human-like walking, topped by an ape-like brain, challenged that idea. Johansson placed Lucy's kind at the center of a dramatic split in hominid evolution, with A. afarensis evolving in one direction into later Australopithecines, and in another direction into the Homo genus. That view is still held by Johansson and many others today. At a minimum, Lucy's partial skeleton strengthened the argument, until then based on the tiny skull, that a two-legged stride arrived before the emergence of big brains in human evolution. Lucy's lower body design triggered a related dispute. Her spine and legs were adapted for an upright gait, which would reinforce her proposed status as a direct Homo ancestor. But relatively long arms and curved fingers resembled those of a tree-climbing ape. After Lucy's discovery, researchers debated whether the species divided its time between the trees and the ground, or mainly stayed on the ground despite retaining skeletal traits of tree-climbing ancestors. Lucy's preferred mode of getting around remains a hot topic. Frequent tree climbing, possibly linked to exceptional upper body strength, would support a controversial proposal that she fell to her death from high up in a tree. If an efficient two-legged stance kept Lucy grounded, as suggested by another A. afarensis fossil find, then she probably died from some other cause. Crucial questions also concern her species' diet and possible stone tool use. In 2000, at another Ethiopian site, researchers discovered the nearly complete fossil skeleton of a 3-year-old girl from Lucy's species, which they named Silam. Later evidence from that site suggests that A. afarensis used stone tools to obtain marrow, meat, and fat from animal carcasses. If those findings hold up, then meat eating did not rapidly lead to bigger hominid brains, as many researchers have assumed. Make the right scientific friends. Lucy attracted big-time researchers from the moment Johansson and Gray started retrieving parts of her skeleton. The evolutionary status of the ancient Hadar hominid and her kind soared, thanks to her newfound admirers' collaborative efforts and publications. Johansson, Lucy's first champion, arrived at Hadar in 1972 as part of an international fossil hunting expedition. His colleagues included 3 already distinguished researchers, all now deceased: paleoanthropologist Yves Copin, geologist John Kelb, and geologist Maurice Taieb, who had discovered the Hadar formation in 1968 and organized the expedition. The team became immersed in excavating more Hadar fossils, with a first wave of fieldwork running through 1977. Johansson recruited a young paleoanthropologist who would go on to have a bright future in fossil hunting and analysis, Tim White, to help analyze the growing trove of ancient bones. It was in a 1978 paper that Johansson, White, and Coppens identified Lucy and other fossil hominids at Hadar and another East African site, Laetoli, as a new species. White added a keen eye and voluminous knowledge of bones to the early studies of Lucy and her kind. In 1991, White published Human Osteology, a classic book on how to analyze human skeletons that is still in print. The next year, he published an influential book on how to recognize signs of cannibalism on human bones. He later directed excavations of a 4.4 million-year-old partial hominid skeleton, known as Ardi, that also shook up the human family tree. Johansson thrived in a role as scientific popularizer. His 1981 book, Lucy, The Beginnings of Humankind, co-authored with writer and naturalist Maitland Eide, brought her worldwide attention. In the same year, newscaster Walter Cronkite moderated a nationally televised debate between Richard Leakey and Johansson. Though fieldwork stopped in 1977 due to an increasingly violent Ethiopian civil war, in 1981, Johansson met an anthropology graduate student who would direct a second wave of Hadar excavations. William Kimball started out by analyzing brain case remains of A. afarensis. In the early 1980s, he worked with Johansson and White to detail why A. afarensis and A. africanus were different species. Kimball took charge of a new phase of fieldwork in 1990 as the Civil War neared its official end the next year. He raised funds for, organized, and directed A. afarensis excavations for the next three decades. During the 1990s, he helped lead a movement to understand different species concepts and their implications for primate evolution. Lucy's kind had no better Homo sapiens friend than the paleoanthropologist everyone called Bill. Paleoanthropology suffered an enormous loss in 2022 when Kimball, who also directed the Institute of Human Origins at Arizona State University from 2009 to 2021, died of abdominal cancer at age 68. Kimball, like Lucy's discoverers, had argued that she is a direct ancestor of the Homo genus, a proposal that remains controversial. To this day, few early Homo fossils exist for comparison with A. afarensis. Kimball contributed to the analysis of one such find, a roughly 2.8 million-year-old Homo jaw found near Hadar. In his view, traits of that fossil indicate that one branch of Lucy's species evolved into the first members of the genus Homo and eventually gave rise to Homo sapiens. During the televised debate between Johansson and Richard Leakey, Johansson presented a drawing of his proposed hominid family tree. Leakey scrawled a question mark over it. Decades later, Lucy and her Hadar crowd still elude scientific consensus. But no matter how this pivotal evolutionary issue plays out, Lucy's trip from a Hadar gully to an Ethiopian museum vault has been eventful for her species and anyone interested in the origins of humankind. 50 years after stopping a couple of fossil hunters in their tracks, Lucy's star power shines bright. Lucy is indeed in the sky with diamonds. And this feature appears in the November 16th, 2024 issue of Science News. And from Advances, in the December 2024 issue of Scientific American, we return to the topic of oceans. Deep knowledge. Strange biotwang near the Mariana Trench identified. Recorded by underwater microphones, the unexplained sound, a low, sonorous grunting followed by a squeaky mechanical echo, like a frog burping in space, first rumbled through a computer speaker about a decade ago. Baffled researchers called it the biotwang. "You've got this low-frequency portion like a moan," says Lauren Harrell, a data scientist at Google's AI for Social Good team, adding her own impression of a hearty groan. Then you have the higher frequency component that sounds, to me, like the original Star Trek Enterprise ship, the bip-boo, bip-boo sound. Autonomous underwater gliders first encountered the odd noise in 2014, echoing near the miles-deep Mariana Trench in the Western Pacific Ocean. Researchers couldn't identify its source, but they had a theory. There are enough other Star Wars-sounding whale calls that they guessed it was made by a baleen whale, says Anne Allen, a research oceanographer at the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. But, she adds, anybody who's not familiar with whales would never think this was made by an animal. Confirming which marine creature makes a particular unusual noise isn't easy. It requires a person on a boat to see and identify the source at exactly the same time the sound is heard. It takes a lot of time, a lot of effort, and a fair amount of luck, Allen says. That's how Allen, Harrell, and their colleagues finally solved the BioTwang mystery, which they describe in Frontiers in Marine Science. While surveying whales off the Mariana Islands, an archipelago near the trench of the same name, NOAA researchers saw an enigmatic baleen species called the Bride's Whale 10 times. These rarely observed whales have a vast range spanning much of the ocean, making them hard to study. On 9 of the 10 occasions when Bride's whales turned up, the researchers also heard the BioTwang. Once it's a coincidence, Allen says. Twice is happenstance. 9 times, it's definitely a Bride's whale. After identifying the source, the scientists reviewed years' worth of audio data from underwater hydrophones to figure out where this specific whale sound had previously been heard. But according to Allen, NOAA's growing database has more than 200,000 hours of such recordings. It's so much data that it's simply impossible to analyze manually, says Olaf Meinecke, who studies baleen whales as a research fellow at Griffith University in Australia, and who wasn't involved in the study. When analyzing audio data for another project, Allen had been flabbergasted by the huge volumes of information to slog through. At one point, she says, her dad suggested, just get Google to do it for you. So Allen reached out to company staff, and to her surprise, they agreed. Google provided AI tools that helped to speed up her analysis by transforming audio data into an image called a spectrogram, and then training algorithms to look for certain frequencies using image recognition. The new study lays out the evidence associating BioTwangs with Bride's whales in the western North Pacific. The data suggest that the animals the researchers studied are members of a distinct Bride's whale population and showed where in the ocean they were found during different seasons and years, something that had previously been challenging to discern because scientists couldn't easily tell different populations of the elusive whales apart. In 2016, after a strong El Niño led to a shift in the location of the whales' food, largely krill, sardines, and anchovies, there were lots of BioTwangs, even in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, an area these whales ventured into only under certain climate conditions. This correlation could mean that their movements are at least partially determined by their prey's distribution, which changes with environmental conditions. Once scientists know where and when these whales travel, Harrell says, AI models could connect those data to climate and environmental factors, and thus support protection efforts. As climate change worsens and El Niño and its cold water counterpart, La Niña, potentially undergo changes, these whales will have to travel farther, and they may have to work a little harder to find food, Allen says. The data processing technology isn't perfect. These algorithms can only search for a frequency they know, Meinecke says. Baleen whale vocalizations change over time and between populations, but because the tools are open source, other scientists can use them to discover more about whale language. we seem to be so detached from or simply have no access to this amazing acoustic underwater world, he says. I think it's about time that we change that. This advance posted by Melissa Hobson. And now for a bit of history, compiled by Mark Fischetti. 50, 100, and 150 years ago. From 1974, more alcohol found in space. Is there intelligent life elsewhere in the universe? Positive evidence facetiously adduced was that whereas methyl alcohol had been discovered in interstellar space, ethyl alcohol, the potable kind, had not. Clearly, someone had consumed the stuff. But in October, a group of researchers used a highly sensitive spectrometer to investigate the dense cloud of gas and dust, designated Sagittarius B2, a rich source of most of the known molecules in space. They discovered weak radio emission at the wavelength of 3.3 millimeters and identified it as radiation from ethyl alcohol. Ethyl alcohol, composed of 9 atoms, C2H5OH, is one of the largest and most complex molecules now known to exist in interstellar space. The substance is spread in a thin vapor throughout Sagittarius B2, which is some 50 light-years in diameter. One calculation shows that if the ethyl alcohol were condensed, it would come to 10 to the 28th fifths of a gallon at 80 proof. However, there might be a problem. The alcohol is heavily contaminated with substances such as hydrogen cyanide, formaldehyde, and ammonia. The discovery brings the total number of different kinds of molecules detected in space to 32. That was 50 years ago. What about 100 years ago, or more accurately now 101? In 1924, methanol is a safer name. Some time ago, attention was called to the coinage of this word to designate methyl alcohol, commonly called wood alcohol. The purpose was to provide a trade designation which would not involve the word alcohol and consequently detract from the use of this material as a beverage. In 1 year, in one of our larger cities, there were 54 deaths traceable to the internal use of wood alcohol. As soon as the word methanol had been accepted by the trade and users, the number of deaths in the same locality dropped to less than 20 in a year. It is believed that a great deal more has been accomplished by this ingenious device than would have been possible by any campaign of education or legal enforcements. And what about chromosomes? Not jelly. With the microscopic study of the cell and its constituent parts and the rediscovery of Mendel's law in 1900, two formerly independent lines of investigation have reinforced each other. We now know that living cells are not mere drops of jelly. Each contains a complexity of parts, one of which is the easily dyed speck called the nucleus. The nucleus, in turn, contains a number of highly important microscopic constituents called chromosomes, of which each species of plant or animal possesses a characteristic number. Although the nature and behavior of these little chromosome particles are not fully understood, it is quite evident that they have very much, if not everything, to do with determining the great facts of heredity. And then, 1874, or 151 years ago, paintings bask in the limelight. The new and celebrated painting, Roll Call, by Lady Elizabeth Butler, is now nightly exhibited in London to large audiences by means of the oxyhydrogen light, or limelight, and all the colors of the picture are brought out with marvelous brilliancy. In fact, with the same perfection as by daylight. The idea of illuminating art galleries in the evening by the limelight is an excellent one. The yellow color of the ordinary gas flame reveals only a portion of the colors of the paintings. The reds and yellows are seen well enough, but the blues and greens and their various tints are sadly distorted, and the artistic effect lost. Limelight obviates such difficulties. And there's a note that Levitt Ibbotson is credited with pioneering the use of limelight in photography. An oxyhydrogen flame, which is a mixture of oxygen and hydrogen, heated a piece of quicklime until it became white hot, creating incandescence. And finally, also in 1874, we learned about sanitary hospital walls. A writer in the London Builder suggested that thick glass might be easily and cheaply cemented to the walls of hospitals. It would be non-absorbent, imperishable, easily cleaned, readily repaired if damaged by accident, and unlike paper and paint, would always be as good as at first. Glass can be cut or bent to any required shape. If desired, the plates may be colored any cheerful tint. The non-absorbent quality is the most important for hospitals and prisons, and we should think is worthy the consideration of architects. And this history was compiled by Mark Fischetti for the last page of the December 2024 issue of Scientific American. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ehlich, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week.